Welcome to another episode of Radio Werewolf. I'm your host for tonight, Dion, right here on RadioWerewolf.com. It's December 15th, 2015. Tonight, we're going to do a little special thing here. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about who really runs the White House. I know we all know it's not Barack Obama, but then who is it? And this is kind of late in the game to be doing this show, I know, but I haven't been doing this very long, maybe like 6-7 months now. So it's good a time as any. There's one person that nobody really talks about when they're talking about the White House staff, and that's actually Valerie Jarrett. And if there's anybody who actually runs the damn show, it's her. So we'll get into that. But one little thing I want to bring up beforehand. So you guys got to make sure you check out all the good shows here on RadioWerewolf.com. We got a full lineup. We've got a show every day of the week, unless I feel like going out. But no, this Saturday we'll definitely have a show. I know I missed last Saturday because I had other plans. Damn me for going out and doing other things. But yes, this Saturday we will have a show. So don't you worry about that. But like I said, we have shows every day of the week here. Got a lot of good shows. Actually, another thing I wanted to bring up, you guys really got to check out that new Blackbird show. He does great work. He kind of had a orientation sort of thing last week. Laid out everything he's planning on doing. Kind of introduced himself. It was a pretty good show. You guys should really check that out. Now, he'll be on tomorrow night. I don't know what he's talking about on his show tomorrow, but I'm sure it'll be good. So if anybody wants to call in, call in numbers 929-477-3574. I really don't care if people call in today. But like I said, what I wanted to talk about tonight was Valerie Jarrett. And understand this whole thing, you kind of have to go back in time. You have to look at the history of this, just like I do with everything else. You always got to go look back in the past to see where we got to where we are now. I'm a real firm believer in that. That's just kind of my thing. And that's why people listen to me, I guess. All right. So in 1969, an undercover policeman named William Frappalli took the stand at the infamous Chicago 7 trials. Prosecutors asked him to describe his collaboration with organizers of the violent protest that roiled the previous year's Democratic National Convention. Frappalli testified that on one chaotic night in Lincoln Park, Maryland Katz briefed a group of protesters on an addition to their arsenal of anarchy called Gorilla Nails. She had two types, he recounted. One was a cluster of nails that were sharpened on both ends, and they were fastened in the center. It looked like they were either welded or soldered. She said these were good for throwing or for putting underneath tires. Now, Katz wasn't just an aggressive foot soldier in the anti-war movement. She was the head of security for the students of a democratic society, a hardcore leftist cabal from which AIRS, militant weathermen organization, splintered away. As the SDS security commander-in-chief, Katz was intimately familiar with the group's extreme tactic, which were employed repeatedly in clashes with authorities. 4 decades later, Katz had traded in her gorilla nails for manicured nails. Now, to be clear, she never graduated to the bombs and bullets approach of Bill Ayers, but she did. Well, she also seems to have grown up a bit since her SDS glory days and has cultivated a political consulting career in Obama's hometown. Katz has not, however, abandoned her left-wing ideology. She was one of the principal organizers of the now infamous 2002 anti-war rally at which Barack Obama followed through on his, quote, most gut-wrenching decision, unquote, of his entire life by publicly warning against the war in Iraq. Katz has since described the events as Obama's coming out as a public speaker. That was his coming out as a public speaker. This, of course, is not to be confused with his original political coming out party at the Ayers residence in the mid-1990s. Ever since Obama decided to run for president, he's been doing his best to dismiss, deny, or obfuscate his long-standing relationship with Ayers and Dorn. After all, mainstream politicians don't usually have close working relationships, let alone friendships, with people who once declared war on the United States government. Katz, on the other hand, appears to have been welcomed by Obama with open arms. She serves as his National Finance Committee. She is listed as a fundraising bundler, and she also hosted fundraisers for him and personally donated thousands of dollars to his cause. Katz also traveled to Denver as part of the Illinois delegation, serving as a member of the Credentials Committee. There are so many objectionable figures in Obama's social circles. New revelations about yet another garden variety radical may elicit shrugs at this point. How have we arrived in such a place? His supporters have made it clear that his close ties to unrepentant terrorists were actually no big deal. In fact, those who raised concerns about Obama Ayers nexus were labeled viciously as conspiracy theorists. So perhaps it follows that someone who preferred lobbing gorilla nails at police over planting pipe bombs in federal buildings would be integrated into Obama's official campaign apparatus without so much as a second look. Maybe her slot on the National Finance Committee was a long delayed reward for her admirable show of restraint. When Ayers first became a political liability for Obama, the Chicago Sun-Times ran a news story entitled "Who is Bill Ayers?" In case readers were foolish enough to think Ayers' connection was a big deal, a voice of reason was quoted to set them straight. Quote, "What Bill Ayers did 40 years ago has nothing to do with it now," unquote. The source went on to detail that Ayers' wonderful work in the field of public education. Who was this great moral authority who wrote this piece? Well, it was Marilyn Katz. Of course, identified as the public strategist and a former member of a quote-unquote peaceful Students for a Democratic Society. Leave it to the mainstream media to quote Miss Gorilla Nails, declaring that Mr. Wish I Had Done More Bombings should be irrelevant, while adding that he's really a swell guy these days. Now, unlike Ayers, Dorn, or Jeremiah Wright, the name Marilyn Katz is not well known, even among conservative observers of the radical left. To briefly summarize, Katz has provided security for the Students for a Democratic Society during the quote-unquote days of rage protests of the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, where she invented the gorilla nails, and which SDS members could throw at police. In the 1971 to 1972, Katz would lead a remnant of the imploding SDS to form the New American Movement, a combination of old left and new left organization that included the Communist Party USA, of course. A few years later, Katz founded the Reproductive Rights National Network, which intended to enroll pro-abortion activists in a larger crusade for quote-unquote child care, national health care, high-quality education, and guaranteed income. I don't know how you can guarantee somebody an income, but those leftists always like to push that out there, too. In 1983, NAM, or the New American Movement, merged with Michael Harrington's Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee to form the Democratic Socialists of America. As the website of the Freedom Socialist Party notes, social democrats such as the Democratic Social Organizing Committee and the New American Movement long ago disappeared into the Democratic Party. Then Katz started a public relations firm and led the charge for the election of Chicago Mayor Harold Washington, which was a major triumph for the socialist left. That's where she met Michelle Robinson and her fiancé, Barack Obama. So Katz and the Chicago Limousine Liberal, Betty Lou Saltzman, organized the 2002 anti-war demonstration featuring a speech from the state senator, Barack Obama, which he used to burnish his anti-war credentials en route to capturing the 2008 Democratic presidential nomination. Katz continued to encourage socialists to radicalize the Democratic Party. In a 2004 article entitled From Protest to Politics, she and co-author Carl Davison encouraged revolutionaries to vote for John Kerry, although they insisted that the United States would still be an imperialist power, under Kerry, at least under a Democrat. The United States would quote, not quite as dangerous to peace abroad, unquote. Continuing her efforts to radicalize the mainstream, Katz bundled at least $50,000 for Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, as did Code Pink activist Jody Evans. After Obama's election, she reportedly offered a barely concealed bribe to Governor Rod Blagojevich. I know that's not how you pronounce it, but anyways, the ex-governor of Illinois. Okay. So anyways, she barely concealed a bribe to the governor of Illinois in exchange for naming Valerie Jarrett to Obama's vacant Senate seat. Blago wrote in his book, after Katz failed to schedule lunch with his wife, Patty, Katz contacted him and indicated that if I appointed Valerie Jarrett to the U.S. Senate, the Obama people would help raise money from their network of contributors across the country. So if they did this for him, all these leftists would raise money for his next campaign. Despite her poise as a simple Democrat, her goals and ideology have remained unchanged. At the 40th anniversary of the Days of Rage, an interviewer from the In These Times asked, in this age of terrorism, if she regretted her role in the riots. She replied, quote, I regret nothing. However, she ventured, I would probably reject violence as a useful form of revolution. Just probably. She told In These Times, it's a leftist magazine, In These Times, quote, what is really interesting to me, unquote, is that Ayers and Dorn had figured out a way to not join the system, but make changes to it. One of the ways they effected change was by supporting Barack Obama. In the same interview, Katz exposed her socialist attitudes. Katz exposed to her socialist audience the left's conclusion with Barack Obama. She said she and her followers, her and her fellow fringers had to elect Obama and continually push him in the direction of Fabian socialism, but without going so far as to tip off the arrogant patriot Americans. We have to get him into office so that we can be the left opposition. I think it is a delicate balance between those of us who are progressive, how much we should push, how much you don't want to put him in a difficult position that would embarrass him or give John McCain some advantage. In her article, What We Lost After We Won in 2008, Kat Purs, the reason Obama's party lost a blowout midterm election is because he failed to motivate the far left. To remedy this, she proposed, we must build a national grassroots vehicle that Obama for America and Organizing for America could have been. This organization must be broad enough in scope to develop and promote a progressive agenda, and it should also allow all types of involvement, whether online or in person, occasional or consistent. The article's centerpiece is this. Crucially, the organization's members would not only articulate a progressive agenda and interact with congressional leaders on the ground, but also be broad and creative enough in their thinking to involve the ordinary everyday people who found both meeting and community in 2008. Anyone familiar with Katz in the history of the left, of which she is a creature, knows what she's calling for is a new popular front. In the 1930s, the Communist Party USA made common cause with as many liberal organizations, and especially unions, as possible to push America further into a command economy and draw the nation into World War II as allies of Joseph Stalin. The CPUSA hoped not only to drive the public left, but to use useful idiots to cover themselves to appear mainstream. Katz's article seems the modern complement. Barack Obama's heart is the far left, and he desperately seeks popular cover to implement an agenda it knows the American people will reject. That is why he finances covert propaganda such as blogger Tracy Russo, anonymously attacking conservative websites that disagree with his position. That is why he hosts cultural policy summits with conspiracy theorists from the Universal Zulu Nation, left-wing activist Sally Cohn exposed the weekly common purpose meetings Obama called Obama called to convince like-minded extremists to support his administration. That is why Education Secretary Arne Duncan invited 40,000 federal employees to attend Al Sharpton's Reclaim the Dream rally, scheduled to compete with Glenn Beck's Restore Honor rally on 28th. And that is why he submitted a report to the UN Human Rights Commission that proclaimed socialism a human right, while criticizing Arizona's immigration law, and earned a UN condemnation of Jan Brewer's law. Like the UN had anything to do with fucking Arizona's law. But they got the UN to condemn Jan Brewer. So now, Marilyn Katz is opening another front on Obama's behalf while strategically nudging him more to the left. Glenn Beck has speculated that once these efforts gain enough ground, the socialists will begin to expose themselves. The rapid-fire emergence of Ayers, Dorn, and Katz led support to his conclusions. Some of us have known Obama's ideological extreme since before the 2008 election. Unlike the mainstream media, he has really made a little secret of it. The question remains, after all the damage he has inflicted, will America fall for the PR smokescreen or insist that the newly elected Republicans pry Obama and his radical minions' hands off the levers of power? Or do we even have a character to reject socialism anymore? So that was a little bit of the background of Marilyn Katz, who's kind of more or less the head socialist in Obama's circle in Chicago. Which actually brings me to my next story here, which ties us in with Valerie Jarrett, who's Obama's senior advisor. And she is actually the one who runs the show, not Obama. You know, we all say the politicians are a puppet, right? We all say that. We all know that. But people really don't look into the background of these people and see who really controls the show. We're like, oh, it's the Jews. But which Jews are they? Like, I like to go back and name the names. You just can't see it, the Jews, and let it lie there. This is entitled The Marxist Web of Chicago. It's Marilyn Katz, the enabler of Valerie Jarrett. Okay, so how did Valerie Jarrett become one of the most powerful women in Chicago? And actually, who is Valerie Jarrett? Part of Jarrett's identification with the president is her international childhood and experience as an African American growing up abroad. She was born in Iran to a renowned physician father and spent the first 5 years of her life in Iran. There, she said she was treated as an American and not as an African American. Of course, they all say that crap too. You're like, oh, I was in a different country, and they treated me so much better than they treat us in the United States. Bullshit. I've met some goddamn people from Iran. They don't like black people at all. So her family lived in London for 1 year before settling in Chicago's elite neighborhood, Hyde Park, where she was teased both for her race and for her British accent. Because damn kids. Chicago-based journalist Lynn Sweet reports, in the manner of privileged Hyde Park Kenwood, children from smart families, Jarrett went to an exclusive University of Chicago lab school before transferring to her mother's alma mater, Northfield Mount Hermon in western Massachusetts, for the last 2 years of high school. After graduating from the University of Michigan Law School, she went to work for Chicago's first African-American mayor, Harold Washington, whose election many 60 radicals attributed to themselves. After Washington's death in 1987, she stayed under his successor, Richard Daley. In City Hall, she and her colleague, Susan Scher, recruited Michelle Robinson, then engaged to Barack Obama, and Jarrett quickly melded her way into their lives. After Daley administration infighting, Jarrett continued to serve Daley in a different capacity and found a job in Habitat, a real estate firm headed by Daniel Levin. Now, Daniel Levin is the cousin of Senator Carl Levin and Representative Sander Levin of Michigan. Now, in the chat room, it says that Harold Washington overdosed on cocaine while at work on the mayor's desk. That would not surprise me that a black man would have a cocaine overdose when he's supposed to be, quote unquote, at work. Oh, Michelle Malkin has noted the tracks of public housing, including that bearing the name of her grandfather, have deteriorated after being run by Habitat, although the New York Times lists the stint as quote-unquote baggage, it proved profitable, and she has gone on to sit on numerous corporate, civic, and academic boards. Sweet noted, of to whom Jarrett owed much of her success, activist public affairs consultant with close ties to City Hall, Marilyn Katz, introduced Jarrett to Levin. So who is this person to whom Jarrett is so indebted? And who, we shall see, is the person that she calls a personal friend. Marilyn Katz provided security for the Students for a Democratic Society in the 1968 convention. Okay, so after the SDS imploded, Bill Ayers, who Katz has known since she was 17, helped create the terrorist Weather Underground from its ranks. Where was I? So anyways, Rabbi Michael Lehner was among its earlier founders. Oh, this is talking about NAM again. Why did it take this out? Okay. So Katz became an organizational entrepreneur herself, founding MK Communications. Now, is that MK for Marilyn Katz? Is that for MK Ultra? It could be, since it's a public relations firm. The clients of Marilyn Katz's public relations firm includes the ACLU, Amnesty International, Chicagoans Against War and Injustice, Harold Washington's 1983 to 1987 mayoral campaign. It's a pretty long list, so I'm not going to read all these. Human Rights Watch, of course, Illinois Coalition Against the Death Penalty, bunch of unions, bunch of socialist groups. You get the idea. Oh, Katz did spin for the developers of the presidential towers, a HUD-financed yuppie haven, which moved homeless people out of Skid Row in hopes of moving the upper middle class into their place. The new Mayor Daley's re-encroachment with the SDS nail throwers became most conspicuous in 1996 when he, Katz, and the Chicago 7 did PR for the 1996 Republican National Convention, which had returned to Chicago. The Chicago Tribune's John Cass reported, even if he laid off 1,000 city workers, he gave Katz and other public relations firms 5-year contracts that would pay them as much as $5 million each. As part of Katz's work for the city, she wrote press releases for Chicago's Transit Authority, then headed by Valerie Jarrett. Katz had a few other noteworthy clientele. So there's Project Vote, the Acorn-affiliated voter registry that first brought Barack Obama to Chicago as a communist organizer. The Habitat Company, the Joyce Foundation, on whose board Obama sat. The History Makers, which interviewed Valerie Jarrett, her mother, and her father-in-law. Katz called on her radical Rolodex in 2002 when she and former National Secretary Carl Davidson cited Chicagoans Against War in Iraq. Katz and Betty Lou Saltzman organized the 2002 anti-war demonstration, where the little-known state senator Obama gave his famous speech, calling it a stupid war and a conspiracy by Karl Rove to distract from the failing economy. This speech made Obama the choice of his party's left wing in 2008. Obama knew, or Katz knew, of Obama politically and through Valerie Jarrett. Davidson, too, knew of Obama, writing on the Marxist mailing list. He had, quote, known Obama from the time he came to the new party to get our endorsement for his first ever race. I've been in his home, and as an Illinois legislator, He's helped our community technology. I think it's supposed to be our. He helped our community technology movement a number of times. He later assessed on the Obama economic speech, finding, quote, "I probably couldn't have written a better one myself," unquote. Together, he and Katz wrote the book Stopping War, Seeking Justice, Essays in a Time of Empire. Now a longtime beneficiary of Democratic spoils, Katz has put her new organization to work for the party, the CAWI, which lists allies like MoveOn.org, Code Pink, International Answer, Rainbow Push Coalition, and The World Can't Wait, trained 200 people to register voters in 2003. Katz and Davidson wrote an article from Protest to Politics urging radicals to support Democrat John Kerry. 4 years later, in a blog entry adorned with a picture of Barack Obama, Davidson urged readers of the CAWI homepage, quote, "break decisively with the ultra-left mindset in order to deepen and broaden left progressive unity," unquote. Davidson later attempted to defend Obama by saying, Obama is a decent liberal out of the Alinsky tradition of community organizers. Everyone knows there's nothing Marxist about Alinsky. Okay. I'm simply an acquaintance of Obama, meeting him three times for more than a few minutes for 15 years. Herald of Washington's movement, for instance, was launched by black nationalists and independent black voters, hardly connected to the socialist left. Okay. Obama really does have a mentor, but it's certainly not me. It's two very tough, accomplished, influential, and smart liberal black women, Valerie Jarrett and Susan Rice. Yeah, so apparently the black nationalists and the independent black Democrats aren't socialists at all. Anybody with two brain cells to rub together could figure out that's a lie. Even leftists would know that's a lie. Okay. If Katz's tactics have changed, her underlying ideology has not. In an article, Katz and Davidson agreed, quote, "it is true that the next president of the United States will represent one or another imperialist grouping. We should do this without illusions. The day after Bush's defeat, the U.S. will still be an imperialist power," unquote. All right. So late August, Katz and her old SDS comrade, Don Rose, who mentored David Axelrod, another friend of Marilyn Katz, met with the In These Times to discuss the 40th anniversary of the Days of Rage. Oh, yeah, that's why I left this part in here. I'm like, why did I leave this in here? I just read this part. No, this is why I left this part in here, because it's a little bit different than the other part. When asked if she learned anything from the violence, she first charged the FBI with having 28 Black Panthers assassinated, calling the mythical murders a wake-up call if we saw the underbelly of our own country. So she accused the FBI of killing 28 Black Panthers. She then offered her takeaway from 40 years of reflection on the rebellion she led. And like I read before, I would have to say for me, permanently, I would probably reject violence as a useful form of revolution. So Katz is not merely a friend of Jarrett's, but also of both of the Obamas. The president met with Katz through his first job at a law firm run by Judd Minor. The New York Times reports Katz gave him entry into another activist network. The foot soldiers of the white students and black power movements that helped to define Chicago in the late 1960s. Michelle Obama has a close social ties with her as well. Biographer Lisa Mundy quotes Katz as saying that the moment Jared introduced Michelle Obama to her friends, Michelle was recognized as brilliant and beautiful. I don't know how fucking call Michelle Obama beautiful, and immediately accepted into her very sophisticated social circle. Mundy writes Michelle, quote, and Barack enjoy a range of relations with people who share their lifestyle. What does that mean? Their lifestyle. As well as their progressive views and political involvement. These are folks, says Marilyn Katz, a member of their social circle, who talk to their friends a number of times a day. Mundy describes a 2008 fundraiser for the DSA member, Representative Jan Szczekowski, which Katz attended and Michelle Obama addressed. From their common social circle, Katz is welcomed into the Obama campaign. Like cold pink radical Jody Evans, Marilyn Katz became a bundler for Obama, as well as a member of his National Finance Committee. Actually, you know what? I think I'm going to take a quick break here. My eyes are starting to get crossed a little bit. Play a quick song here. I didn't even check the call board. Yeah. So actually, everything I'm playing tonight is actually bands from Chicago. I always like to have a little theme. Have the music go along with whatever I'm talking about. And I'm not going to play a bunch of hippie songs. So that was my idea of keeping the theme going. So like the first band I played was the Gossicles. They're from Chicago. I'm going to play some Ministry. This is New World Order.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back to Radio Werewolf. I'm your host for tonight, Dion, right here on RadioWerewolf.com. And tonight we're talking about Valerie Jarrett, the real person who's behind the scenes who controls the Obama administration. We'll go a little bit into her background. So her late father-in-law, Vernon Jarrett, was a pioneering black journalist in quote-unquote Negro newspapers. After graduating from Knoxville College, Vernon Jarrett started the Chicago Defender in 1946, where he wrote columns extolling communist poet Langston Hughes, his lifelong Stalinists such as E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, contemporary writer at Kansas City Star, asserts by 1948 Jarrett had been forced out of journalism by the Cold War, the Red Scare, and racism. He freelanced at Kansas City's The Call from 1954 to 1958, then returned to Chicago to become the first nationally syndicated black columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and still later wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times. Valerie married his son, William Robert Jarrett, who preceded his father in death. Together they had a daughter who now attends Harvard. I don't know why they had to put that in there. The elder Jarrett may have been part of his daughter-in-law's rise through Chicago's political ranks. The Washington Post called Jarrett a key influence in Harold Washington's decision to run for the Chicago mayoral race. Vernon Jarrett later wrote of another up-and-coming political figure in the Chicago Sun-Times. Yeah, I'm not going to read this whole thing. he wrote about Barack Obama. When Vernon died in 2004, he was saluted in the pages of the People's Weekly Worker, the house organ of the Communist Party USA, a final point of confluence, perhaps, more than anything. Vernon once sat upon the union publicity committee with Frank Marshall Davis, the communist poet who occasionally counseled the young Barack Obama. Valerie Jarrett had more immediate radical ties. Her mother, Barbara Taylor Bowman, there's a big typo in here. That's why it didn't make any sense to me. They wrote it twice. Okay, so Valerie Jarrett had more immediate radical ties. Her mother, Barbara Taylor Bowman, co-founded the Erickson Institute in Chicago and still serves on its board of trustees. Tom Ayers, the father of Bill Ayers, was also a one-time trustee. According to WorldNet Daily's Brad O'Leary, the Erickson board also included Bill Ayers' wife, Bernadine Dorn. For most part, Bill Ayers called Bowman a neighbor and a friend in his book, A Kind and Just Parent, noting his neighbors included Louis Farrakhan, writer, quote-unquote, Barack Obama. And this last reference is the key to understanding the Jarrett and the Obamas. Their common formation by Chicago's elite Hyde Park neighborhood, the University of Chicago essentially created the neighborhood from scratch, driving out its poor and middle-class residents of all races and creating a chic atmosphere of cultural elitism. This bubble reflected the far-left bubble of modern academia, though it would not hurt Obama's political fortitudes, Katz would tell in these times, I believe that Barack Obama could not have emerged in Chicago because of his long-time confluence of radical organizations cultivating in Washington's mayoral race. One of Obama's neighbors, the late left-wing Rabbi Harold Wolf, a Democratic socialist who once invited the Chicago Seven to address his synagogue, described the Hyde Park environment and Obama's place in it to the Weekly Standard. He had a party for him at our house when he was just starting back in the 90s. I said right away, here's a guy who could sell our product and sell it with splendor. And what is the Hyde Park product? The reporter asked. It's a rational progressive philosophy based on experience. You see it here. This neighborhood is generally integrated. We did it here. We really did it. Not just talked about it. Look around. And Barack and his family fit right in. This is their neighborhood. So that's Jared's product and Obama's. An international, ruthless wanderer abomination by his father, or a ruthless wanderer abandoned by his father, an abomination. And occasionally his mother, in search of authenticity. He never felt at home until he found his roots and himself in the milieu of Hyde Park, a neighborhood big enough to encompass everyone from Marilyn Katz to Bill Ayers, from Tony Rezko's vacant adjoining property to Louis Farrakhan's wandering quote-unquote security force, and of course Valerie Jarrett. This is what Jerry reminds Obama of, the neighborhood that has been the president's only true home and shaped or reinforced their values and identity. An elitist sanctuary for pampered radicals, racists, and terrorists, liberated of working class stiffs who bitterly cling to their guns and their religion. Increasingly, it seems as though this is what makes them who they are. And this is becoming the atmosphere Obama, with Jared's help, is recreating in his administration. So now I found this, the next article I have here, I actually found this in the New Republic. Now, the New Republic is kind of a liberal magazine. It's actually, this is the title of the show, The Obama Whisperer. This was written by Noam Schieber. I wonder, what is that guy? Was he a Swede? Noam Schieber. So this is The Obama Whisperer from November 9th, 2014 in the New Republic. So even at this late date in the Obama presidency, there's no surer way to elicit paranoid whispers or armchair psychoanalysis from Democrats than to mention the name Valerie Jarrett. Party operatives, administration officials, they are shocked by her sheer longevity and marvel at her influence. When I asked a longtime source who left the Obama White House years ago for his impressions of Jarrett, he confessed that he was too fearful to speak to me, even off the record. This is not irrational as it sounds. Obama has said he consults Jarrett on every major decision, something current and former aides corroborate. Her role, since she has been at the White House, is one of the broadest and most expansive roles that I can think of that's ever existed in the West Wing, says Anita Dunn, Obama's former communications director. Broader even than the role of running the West Wing. And then the last summer, or was it this summer? No, it was last summer. The call to send the Attorney General Eric Holder on a risky visit to Ferguson, Missouri, was made by exactly three people. Holder himself, the president, and Valerie Jarrett, who were all vacationing together at Martha's Vineyard. When I asked Holder if Dennis McDowell, the chief of staff, was part of this conversation, he thought for a moment and said he wasn't there. And then Holder hastened to add, someone must have spoken to him. So the chief of staff didn't know what the hell was going on when they sent Eric Holder to Ferguson. Valerie Jarrett did. Jarrett holds a key vote on cabinet picks. She opposed Larry Summers as Treasury and was amongst the first of Obama's aides to come around on Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and has been outsized, say, on ambassadorships and judgeships. She helps determine who gets invited to the First Lady's box at the State of the Union, who attends state dinners and bill signing ceremonies, and who sits where at any of the above. She has placed friends and former employees in important positions around the administration. And Jarrett has been known to enjoy the perks of high office herself. When administration aides plan billets, the term of art for meaning of two countries' top officials, they realize that whatever size meeting they are negotiating, whether it's 9x9, 8x8, our side will typically include one less foreign policy hand because Jarrett has a standing seat at any table that includes the president. Not surprisingly, all this influence has won Jarrett's legions of detractors. They complain that she has too much control over who sees the president, that she skews his decision-making with her after-hour visits, that she is an incorrigible yes woman, which I highly doubt that's true, that she has in effect become the chief architect of his very prominent and occasionally suffocating bubble. There is an element of truth to this critique, though. While aboard Air Force One at the end of the 2002 campaign, Jarrett turned to Obama and told him, quote, Mr. President, I don't understand how you're not going to get 85% of the vote, unquote. The other Obama aides in the cabinet looked around in disbelief before concluding that she had said it in earnest. Still, Jarrett's role is far more textured than this narrative would suggest. She has served as the teller of hard truths, urging Obama to clean up his initial remarks about the Harvard professor Harry Louis Gates' arrest in 2009. Which she worried sounded too disrespectful to police. She is an all-wise interpreter of the president's thoughts. Let me read that again. She is an all-wise interpreter of the president's thoughts. When the White House began taking flack for its man cave sensibilities, senior officials consulted Jared to figure out where Obama stood. The White House counsel, Greg Craig, stopped by, recalls a former Jared aide. Quote, he was like, hey, is the president worried about this? And apparently he was. Jared even plays the role of an advanced dining scout for the Obamas. Blah, 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 blah. Jared's jobs may be nothing less than to reflect the most authentic version of Barack Obama himself. Quote, my speculation has always been, when you are any president or Democratic nominee at the pinnacle of American political power, you are necessarily surrounded by layer and layer of bureaucracy. Unquote, says a former White House aide. You're completely disconnected. For someone to come to you and say, I'm going to be the person who is your connection to the real you, is very attractive. So apparently Barack Obama needs Valerie Jarrett to tell him who the fuck he is. So Valerie Jarrett's role in the White House has changed markedly from the first to the second term. So the Clinton alumni, Obama, initially hired to run his White House and hash out his economic policies were flamboyantly centrists, fanatical about winning over financial markets and moderate voters. In their view, a Democratic president would make no bigger mistake than to become a captive of the left. And they acted as if they owned the place. And they certainly didn't view Jared as much of a threat. She had enjoyed real clout on the campaign, but the way she used it, encouraging Obama to give his famous race speech and bringing Latinos, blacks, gays, and women into the heart of the operation at the time when the post-racial rhetoric had gotten thick, didn't win her much respect. Even after Obama made Jared a senior advisor and put her in charge of outreach to constituency groups, her lack of Washington experience made her easy to dismiss. Larry Summers' office was literally across the floor from ours, said a former Jared aide at the president's top economic advisor. It's amazing how little he looked at her, talked to her. It was clear he wanted, or that he kind of wanted nothing to do with her. That was a mistake. Jared was a beloved figure among the fresh-faced Obama hands who flocked to Washington. She shepherded their careers, clucked about their health and turned up unexpectedly at weddings and maternity wards. And though she had been a confidant of Barack's and Michelle Obama's since the early 90s, the three became even closer after the election. It gradually became clear that she had had the president's blessing to challenge his top brass and even align his White House with the outsider ethos of his candidacy. Give me one second here. Okay. Jarrett's inescapable presence made her an object of fear and scorn. It's pretty toxic, says another former administration official. She went to whatever meeting she wanted to go to, basically all of them, and then she would go and whisper to the president. Or at least everyone believed she did. People don't trust the process. They just think she's a spy. Jared also made her influence felt among the men who plotted Obama's political strategy. In the spring of 2010, Donna Brazile, a New Orleans native and Democratic elder who ran Al Gore's presidential campaign, watched with horror as the administration slow-played its response to the BP oil spill. After weeks of back-channeling to White House political director Patrick Gaspard, Brazile finally took her frustration public. Quote, "One of the problems I have with the administration is that it's not tough enough," unquote, she said on ABC. They are waiting for BP to say, "Oh, we've got a new plan to stop the oil leak." They need to stop it, contain it, and clean it up. This set off a debate within the White House over whether the president should call Brazile. Until, according to former aide and chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, shut it down in favor of his longstanding view that the worst thing you can possibly do is reward bad behavior. Jared considered this matter selected, however. She waited until she and Gaspard were safely away from Emanuel and inside the Oval Office, at which point she asked Gaspard a leading question about the utility of a call. Quote, "Sounds good. Get her on the phone," unquote, the president replied. Jared called Brazile and handed the cell phone over to Obama. The move validated everyone's own rival fears of Jared, as with Summer's personal grievances may have explained it. Emanuel had objected to Jared's portfolio at the start of the administration and questioned the Secret Service details she maneuvered to receive a few months later. In return, Jared seemed keen to undermine Rahm Emanuel. At one point, Obama personally ordered Emanuel to rein in his habit of screaming at a subordinate. Emanuel soon lost his cool at a subsequent meeting and received another talking to from the president. He was convinced that Jared had ratted him out. It was the sort of tradecraft Emanuel might himself have admired had he not been on the receiving end of it. A former White House official told me, quote, "In the wild, there would have been natural allies. In captivity, they are becoming natural enemies," unquote. Whatever the case, calling Brazile was unquestionably the right approach. A few months later, the administration pressured an African-American Department of Agricultural employee named Shirley Sherrod to resign after far-right journalists circulated a home video of her appearing to denigrate poor whites. After a few days, it became apparent that this clip was egregiously out of context and that the ouster of Sherrod, whose husband had been a prominent civil rights leader, was unfair. Critics were furious at the trigger-happy White House. Jim Clyburn, the White House third-ranking Democrat, told the New York Times he didn't think that a single black person was consulted before Shirley Sherrod was fired. For her part, Brazile was far less cutting than she had been during the BP spill. She didn't single out the administration for blame. Jarrett's work behind the scenes served the president well, so long as people like Larry Summers, Rahm Emanuel, and Robert Gibbs remained inside the building. She diversified the views he received without stifling internal debate. But then, one by one, the big personalities left. After 2 years, Summers and Gibbs have been replaced by far more amenable actors. Emanuel's strong-willed successor, Bill Daley, lasted less than a year before being replaced by a relative cipher. Today, Obama's top economic advisor, Jeff Zients, a former management consultant, and Jarrett Powell, who had no experience in government before joining the administration, the senior advisor seat that David Axelrod once occupied, now belongs to Dan Pfeiffer, and the chief of staff is Dennis McDonnell. Both joined Obama in 2007 and have long since made their peace with Jarrett's influence. My sense is Dennis does his best not to turn that into a reckoning kind of relationship, said one former White House official. He doesn't want to test it. As Jarrett has outlasted her rivals, it has increasingly fallen on her job to do more than simply protect Obama from those who might undermine his presidency. She must nudge him when he becomes self-satisfied and rein in his worst political impulses. It is a position for which she is uniquely unqualified. Not if she's pushing an actual agenda, so it doesn't matter if she's qualified or not. And apparently, Valerie Jarrett is not above keeping a shit list. Or, as hers is titled, a least constructive list. One progressive activist recalls Jarrett holding the document during a meeting and notices her own name on it, along with the names of others in the room. Quote, it was kind of an honor, the activist told me. That it was not out of character for Jarrett, the woman who once resisted Emanuel's commandment against rewarding bad behavior, has often gone out of her way to suppress dissent among ideological allies and others who question the president. A White House official says that the document was prepared by a staffer acting without orders, and it is not a common practice. Consider her interactions with the LGBT community when they agitated for an executive order banning discrimination by federal contractors. Jared had been one of Obama's biggest supporters for gay rights since the campaign, long before Obama himself, quote unquote, evolved on the marriage question. She had even authored a memo advising the president to sign the executive order. But when Obama decided against it in 2002, he dispatched Jarrett to deliver the news to four or five groups active on the issue. The meeting was a minor fiasco. A BuzzFeed reporter had broken word of the gathering just before it begun, prompting Jarrett to lecture everyone in the room for several minutes about speaking to the press. She fumed that the reporter outside was, quote, waiting for stories, and told the activists that we cannot have White House meetings if you do this kind of thing. Then after ticking off the administration's good deeds on behalf of gays, Jarrett offered no rationale for why Obama was shelving the executive order. She held out the possibility of a study to gauge the order's effect on business, even though the question had been studied to death. About halfway through the meeting, finally proclaimed or finally produced an explanation, a likely legal challenge. But the legal precedent was clear thanks to an executive order banning other forms of discrimination. Had Jarrett leveled with the activists, conceded that the decision was political, probably intended to avoid a backlash among businesses, none of the groups would have been pleased, but many probably would have accepted the verdict and kept the details out of the press. The following fall, the Human Rights Campaign had commissioned a poll showing overwhelmingly bipartisan support for the executive order, which is actually a lie, but declined to make it public for months as not to embarrass the administration. Instead, the reaction in the meeting was woeful, epitomized by the scathing Washington Post piece quoting the activists. Quote, there was a blow-up, unquote, says one longtime advocate. People were withholding money. Straight donors, gay donors were like, what is this? Who wrote this damn thing, a high school kid? When the president made Jared his ambassador to the outside world, he did so with a specific purpose in mind, to communicate how important it is he considered these relationships. Quote, you know, she's speaking for the president more so than anyone else on the staff, unquote, says a trade association leader who has met with Jarrett multiple times. So she's speaking for the president more than anyone else on the staff. But Jarrett's obsessiveness about control and her response to even good faith criticism are often self-defeating. She just cuts off. It's stone cold, says one person who received this treatment. It could be a conversation. A former administration official recalls publicly registering a gentle offhand criticism to the White House, only to draw a one-line email from Jarrett. Why didn't you call me first? Even Jarrett, most benevolent comments, quote, I want you to be my best friend, unquote, she likes to say, implicitly threatening an abrupt loss of favor. All right. With the LGBT community subsidized thanks to the president's unplanned turnout on gay marriage. Oh, but Obama finally did sign the executive order in July. On other issues, her heavy-handedness has cost even more. Earlier this year, after House Republicans rejected John Boehner's overtures on immigration reform, a number of activist groups turned their attention away from Congress and towards the White House. They wanted Obama to sign an executive order protecting illegal immigrants from deportation over the next few years, the way that he had back in 2012 for those who were brought to the country as minors. The pressure mounted when Jarrett Maruga, I don't know, some fucking weird Spanish name, bunch of umlauts and crap. I think it's Maruga. Anyway, Janet Maruga, president of the National Council of Fucking La Raza, one of the largest and most established Latino groups, gave a speech in March calling out both Boehner for having pulled the plug on legislation and Obama for denying he had the authority to act on his own, which essentially the president doesn't. Echoing a line that that was circulating on the left, she dubbed Obama the deporter in chief. If only that was true. A week later, the president and Jared summoned representatives from 15 to 20 reform groups to the White House for a meeting. Now, why do they need 15 to 20 fucking groups at all? Period. Unlike the gay rights meeting 2 years earlier, there was no directive about keeping this discussion out of the press. But the activists guests were later told that the success of the meeting would be judged by the media coverage. The president was in a foul mood, spending most of the next 2 hours lecturing the activists. You guys are turning on me, Obama said, according to several attendees. That's what the Republicans want. You're taking the pressure off of Boehner. If I was a GOP strategist, I would be thrilled by what you're doing. When some of the activists pointed out that the situation in the House was hopeless, Obama would interrupt and talk over them. Finally, when it was LaRosa's turn to speak, she tried to put her earlier remarks in context. She explained that while she'd been critical of the administration, she also criticized Republicans and had urged her community to elect a more amendable Congress. Quote, it took him what felt like 10 minutes. It was probably 30 seconds to compose himself. You could tell and just feel the tension, said one activist in the room, whereupon Obama fell into an extended monologue. You've been around this town, and you know how the press will only report criticisms of me. The LaRosa president looked on the edge of tears as he spoke. And meanwhile, Valerie was sitting next to him, glaring and giving Mariga the stink eye, says the activist. Relations with the group had been critical, only grew worse from there. Some were scrubbed from White House email lists, not invited to subsequent meetings, or both. Another activist recalls not hearing from the White House for months, only to get a passive-aggressive email after leveling a harsh critique of the president. Quote, I don't work for you, unquote, the activist wrote back. In late June, the president reversed course and effectively promised to sign the sought-after executive order by the end of summer. Some of the critics had been rehabilitated, but not from LaRosa, who was left out of the Rose Garden events when the president announced his decision. It was a shitty thing to do, says one of the activists. In another case, the president soon changed his mind yet again. In September, he announced that he wouldn't consider the order until after the election. Suddenly, all the bad that had been built up throughout the years came pouring forth. Quote, where we have demanded leadership and courage from both Democrats and the president, we receive nothing but broken promises and a lack of political backbone, unquote, the head of a prominent pro-immigration group told the Post. Woe is you. If you don't like it, go back to your own fucking country, you beaner bastards. So Jarrett's highly disciplined outreach effort had been a tactical mess. While the White House held some 24 meetings to take the pulse of activists through the summer, there was rarely a meeting back and forth or a meaningful back and forth strategy. Especially in the run-up to the big announcements, it does not make it hard for dissenting voices to be raised, says another activist who deals with the administration at issues. Almost everything is raised to the level of personal loyalty. So the White House, the Clinton White House, was porous and chaotic, with numerous staffers working numerous angles at any given moment. But it made advocates feel like they were part of the process. Quote, the people protected them more with the press, unquote, says one activist. No one protects Obama. Part of being hermetically sealed is if you don't want shit to leak, the higher the premium is on leaks, which gives advocates more of an incentive to leak. In fact, it's precisely because the activists don't feel they are being listened to that they speak to the press. When the White House complains, it exposes itself even further. They show you where they're vulnerable, says the activist. If you're worth your salt as an activist, that's where you hit them, see the deporter in chief. So Obama and Jarrett comparing notes backstage before a reception in Philadelphia in 2011. Jared isn't always standoffish when outsiders are critical. After business leaders complained that the president's occasional populist flourish, most notably his late 2009 comment that "I did not run for office to be helping out a bunch of fat cat bankers," Jared began pressing Axelrod and the speechwriting team to strip potentially inflammatory lines from his public statements. Valerie viewed Wall Street and the business community as a constituency and was generally uncomfortable with their expressions of chastisement towards Wall Street. On one level, it was Jared's job to soothe the fragile egos of corporate executives. The relationship between the White House and business is one of many relationships that Jared's Office of Political Engagement oversees. But on a deeper level, Jared fundamentally empathized with the concerns of business in ways she sometimes didn't with other groups. You could tell she felt at home with private sector business leaders, says the former aide. Even healthcare, it was a presidential priority. The entire White House was involved. But I've never seen her animated until it was a CEO talking about healthcare. This may seem odd with Jared's first term role as Obama's liberal aide, but back then she was largely acting in opposition to the Clintonites around Obama in terms of who she believes has the power to make or break the presidency, and therefore who she needs access to the highest levels of the White House. Jared is not so different from her nemesis. Jared was groomed from birth to be a thoroughly establishment figure. Her family's roots to Chicago's goes back several generations, and she accepted her destiny gracefully. She worked as a corporate lawyer and later ran Mayor Richard Daley's housing and transit authorities. When Harvard Law Professor David Wilkins conducted a study of Chicago legal world in the late 1990s, he found that most of the city's lawyers were acquainted with Valerie Jarrett. Valerie is the liaison between the white North Shore elites and the black South Side elites, he told David Rimrick in The Bridge, a biography of Obama. Upon accepting the White House job, Jarrett resigned from no fewer than 7 corporate and nonprofit boards. Any casual follower of Jarrett's West Wing comings and goings these days will take notice a distinct fondness for big shots, corporate or otherwise. It's not just that Jared is a fixture at the standard A-list events, parachuting into New York for Times Magazine's 100 Most Influential People Gala, popping into the birthday party of Britain's Prince George. Jared also inhabits a much more rarefied plane than the standard Washington emergence. She attends the highest profile arguments at the Supreme Court and often accompanies the president on fundraising trips to New York, Hollywood, and Silicon Valley. She recently made a cameo in The Good Wife and appeared in a Billie Jean King documentary. I don't even know what that is. Valerie is probably the best known person to go to for a real opinion of leaders in the business and in the celebrity world, says a former administration official. By contrast, she came across a board when meeting with the political world's greater operators. One leader of an influential but relatively anonymous advocacy group recalls arranging a meeting with Jared to explain how his team was advancing a cause dear to the president. Quote, "I felt like she was looking at her watch. She was annoyed that I even felt it was reasonable for me to meet with her," says this person. "How dare I take up her time?" No, see, that's why I don't know who the hell Billie Jean King is. Apparently it's some tranny tennis player. That's out of my bubble. Along with this Good Wife thing. I'm assuming it's a TV show or something, or a movie, I don't know. I don't know these things, I don't care. I don't pay attention to some of that stuff. most of that stuff, besides losing my voice. No, in some cases, this outlook has served the administration well. Jarrett made an ally of Rupert Murdoch on immigration reform and sued Silicon Valley in the tense moments after the NSA revelations. She has very strong relationships with Facebook and Google, says her fellow senior advisor, John Pistata. Jarrett also helped mastermind the public relations campaign to enroll 7 million Americans in Obamacare prior to this March's deadline, which was a horrible disaster. She spent months fine-tuning a plan to reach the uninsured where they are, by which she meant enlisting the figures they looked to for guidance, community leaders, DJs, pop culture icons. I can remember dozens of times going back to her with her plans, having this X'd out and that crossed out. This person is a bad idea for this and not that, recalls an aide. Get this part. I don't even care. All right. In other cases, Jarrett's establishmentarianism was simply reinforced by the administration's blind spots. There is, for example, Jarrett's unappreciated influence in areas of budget policy. After Republicans took control of the House in 2011, Obama had decided whether to stick with his efforts to boost the fragile economy or join in the deficit cutting with that the Republicans were demanding. He had actually opted for the latter, agreeing to slice billions from the 2011 budget. While an administration economic officials argued for a stare down the House GOP, the approach never had a chance. That wasn't a huge debate because former advisor David Poloff and Bill Daley and Valerie agreed, a senior White House official told me later that year. The White House believed that avoiding a fight was better for the economy and would help the two sides reach an even bigger deal later on, one that raised taxes and cut trillions in spending over 10 years. That's what we need, more fucking taxes, you bastards. All right. This was flawed in two ways. First, notwithstanding the enthusiasm for deficit cutting on the set of Morning Joe, where Valerie Jarrett is an occasional guest, it was a persuasive priority at the time when the country still faced an unemployment crisis. Second, the White House completely misunderstood the psychology of House Republicans, who took Obama's concessions as a benediction of their anti-spending mania and repeatedly balked at tax increases. Inexplicably, the White House continued to pursue the deal for years after the GOP showed its bad faith efforts that Jarrett supported as well. All right, let me go down this thing. It's a whole lot of nothing. About nothing. All right. Yeah. Yeah, it keeps going back over more and more examples of how she has her foot in the door, how she tells Obama what to do, and how she likes to control everything and be everywhere at the same time. So I think you guys got the gist. I hope you guys learned something. Maybe next week I'll go over the neocons, neocoins. Actually, yeah, maybe I'll do that. Or I might have something else. Because I got some guests coming. Got some guests lined up. I know one for sure I'll have on the 29th. I might have one next week. Not sure. But I got some stuff in the works. I hope you guys enjoy the show. I'm starting to lose my goddamn voice. And I can barely talk anymore. So I hope you guys enjoy the show. Thanks for all listeners. Hope you have a good night. And we'll play you out. Oh, like I said earlier, all the bands I'm playing tonight are all from Chicago. Technically, KMFDM isn't originally from Chicago. Technically, KMFDM is originally from Germany, but they did move to Chicago, so that counts, damn it. Here's Blood versus Money.